With Teresa Tomeo.
We'll keep you closely connected to the faith with the latest from Rome, the front lines of the pro-life movement, and we'll also take a look at other crucial issues facing you and your family in our one holy Catholic and apostolic church.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest of this hour is Father Philip DeVue. Father DeVue is an old friend of mine. He's a pastor of the St. Joseph Parish in Cressis Springs, Kentucky, which is part of the Diocese of Covington, Kentucky. He's from there, but he grew up in Evansville, Indiana, attending St. Louis University and the Pontifical College Josephinum. In addition to be a pastor, he serves on the board of a Catholic radio station in Cincinnati, Sacred Heart Radio, and is regularly on the radio there. Father DeVue, thanks for coming on Church and Culture.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Dale. It's my pleasure.
And since you're a radio veteran, I guess we can just dive right in.
Well, that depends on what we're diving into, but we'll give it a try.
Well, we're diving into something that I think you love as much as I do, and that's poetry of Christmas, some of the great Christmas poetry. And one of the wonderful things about this show is that the title of the show, Church and Culture, enables me to indulge some of my delights in things like music and poetry and philosophy and theology. So we don't have to hold back here. We can just read some poems, talk about them, share them with our listeners. How does that sound?
That sounds marvelous. You know, I have to say my relationship to poetry has always been a troubled one, largely because it was something of a lacuna in my education. Different friends of mine, including your many works over the years, have encouraged me to take that up and to pay more attention to it. A friend of mine who teaches English literature is with a emphasis in poetry. I once grabbed him at a cocktail party and says, I said, you have to teach me how to read poetry. I said, because I feel that my soul is too prose. Yeah. He still loves to quote that back to me. And I don't think I've gotten over my soul being too prose, but it certainly strikes me, Dale, that the Christmas season is one of those great mysteries of our faith, great mysteries of our humanity, the great mysteries of the divinity of God, that really can only be fully appreciated in the words of poetry, in my estimation. And so I was delighted at the topic today, and I'd like to open with sharing one.
Well, do. What is the first poem that you'd like to read aloud, and let's talk about it?
This poem is a poem by Cardinal John Henry Newman. He penned it in 1832, and it's called Christmas Without Christ. For the listeners, it can be found in his little book, Prayers, Verses, and Devotions. So, Newman writes this: how can I keep my Christmas feast in its due festive show, reft of the sight of the high priest from whom its glories flow? I hear the tuneful bells around, the blessed towers I see. A stranger on a foreign ground, they peal a fast for me. O Britons, now so brave and high, how will ye weep the day when Christ in judgment passes by and calls the bride away? Your Christmas then will lose its mirth, your Easter lose its bloom. Abroad a sense of strife and dearth, within a cheerless home. You know, I first read that poem many years ago, and I was at a conference shortly after I had read the poem, and the great Newman scholar Ian Kerr was there, and I went up to Ian Kerr and we had a nice chat, and I asked him about this poem for whatever reason was on my mind at the time, and I asked him, I said, Dr. Kerr, Father Kerr, I said, here's what I think this poem means, and I gave a long explanation, and he said, yeah, I suppose that's as good as any.
Oh, whoa.
he said, of all, I'm not familiar with the poem, so.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean, he had heard of it, you know.
He sounds like he had a lacuna in his poetry education as well.
Well, it just goes to show you can study everything that somebody writes, and you can still not get everything. So
it's true. And
he did.
I noticed that this poem written on Christmas Day in 1832 was written in Malta.
That's correct. That's correct. You know,
I don't know if that has anything to do. Is he chastising the Maltese about their celebrating Christmas but not believing in it? What was?
Well,
what do you think was behind
it? You know, of course, I think the key line there that gives you some sense to what he's talking about, O Britons, now so brave and high. And in my reflection over the poem over many years, I can't reflect on this particular poem and do it without thinking of, you know, of Cardinal Newman's great project, his great intellectual and spiritual project, which negatively was expressed in his opposition to liberalism in religion. You know, that idea that there's no positive truth revealed in religion, which, of course, as you know, Adil, as I'm sure many of your audience members know, was a besetting problem of Christianity in his time, especially when he was in the Anglican Communion. It was an idea that he fought against in the Anglican Communion, an idea that, of course, he continued to oppose when he became a Catholic. And, of course, today his work in this regard, you know, blesses us because it allows us to anchor ourselves in what Newman saw so very clearly, which is that the faith does have positive content. And so I have always viewed this poem, and even the great Newman scholar, Dr. Kerr, has not disabused me of the idea that he was looking at, you know, the collapse of what he saw of belief, of real belief in the real facts of Christianity. And so here was, of course, Britain at the height of its imperial power, Malta being one of its many outposts, seafaring outposts, on Christmas Day, and yet this sense in Newman's poem that there was a real lack of belief in the world. So I don't think he's chastising the Maltese so much as I think he's chastising, you know, his beloved Britain.
Or all of us. Why don't you read it again now that you've talked about it?
Sure.
Christmas Without Christ by John Henry Newman. Go ahead.
How can I keep my Christmas feast in its due festive show, reft of the sight of the high priest from whom its glories flow? I hear the tuneful bells around, the blessed towers I see. A stranger on a foreign ground, they peal a fast for me. O Britons, now so brave and high, how will ye weep the day when Christ in judgment passes by and calls the bride away? Your Christmas then will lose its mirth, your Easter lose its bloom. Abroad a sense of strife and dearth, within a cheerless home.
Beautifully read, but one line that seems to me deliberately ambiguous is, they peel a fast for me. He's talking about how can he keep his Christmas feast if he doesn't have the sight, I assume the faith, in the high priest. And then he says, I am a stranger on a foreign ground, referring to the bells. They peel a fast for me. How do you interpret that?
Well, you know, that which Cardinal Newman so incisively saw in the world was something he, with his tremendous gift of self-examination, always tended, in my study of him over these many years, tended to see first in himself. And so, you know, clearly here John Henry Newman was struggling in himself with this vision of faith, the reality of faith, the facts of faith, and was seeing, I think, and sharing with us a very intimate personal deliberation, a personal struggle, a personal grappling with faith that he also saw, I think, going on in the wider world. So that which, you know...
The fast has two meanings. I mean, fast can mean not to eat, right? To pass
exactly
the supper by. And the other meaning, quickly, I think he means the former here. And
that's correct.
And therefore, he...
And in a double sense, you know, when you read, if you go to Newman's Parochial and Plain Sermons, you know, He tends, you know, he likes to use English words. So being a master of the English language, he likes to use them in their dual forms. And one of the things that you find out in his parochial complaint sermons is that he has this sense of urgency when he talks about the Advent fast. So I think those things are probably not separate from each other. So this sense of urgency, they appeal to fast for me, reminding us, of course, of the penitential reality of waiting for Christ and preparing for Christ, and also the urgency. So I think one could see the dual use of the word there.
Yeah. Great selection. Now I'll give you one of mine. Mine's by another Englishman, not quite so well known for his faith. And that's the novelist Thomas Hardy. Although he was roughly a contemporary of Newman. Maybe
yes.
Came a little later. And this is a poem entitled The Oxen. I'll read it to tell me what you think, Father. Talking with Father Philip DeVue about Christmas poetry. Here's one by Thomas Hardy. Christmas Eve and 12 of the clock. Now they are all on their knees, an elder said as we sat in a flock by the embers in hearthside ease. He pictured the meek, mild creatures where they dwelt in their strawy pen. Nor did it occur to one of us there to doubt they were kneeling then. So fair a fancy few would weave in these years. Yet I feel if someone said on Christmas Eve, come, see the oxen kneel in the lonely barton by yonder coombe our childhood used to know, I should go with him in the gloom, hoping it might be so. What do you think of that expression? It's very ambivalent, but ultimately hopeful. Is Hardy the novelist saying, I wish I could believe?
I think that I have always, when we were discussing the topic for the show today, it had been many, many years since I had read this poem. And, of course, I'm reading it through the lens of, my tutor, Cardinal Newman. And I can't help but think that what he says there is in some ways perfectly expressive deal of so much of what was going on in the 19th century, even to which Cardinal Newman himself grappled with, was this sense of man coming of a new kind of age, forgetting, the old innocence or the old superstition, depending how people saw it, of the old faith, and yet profoundly recognizing that something is missing. And so I read that very much and hear that very much. Hardy's saying, yeah, I really wish I could believe this again. I could return to that innocence of faith, which in itself is maybe a little bit of a misunderstanding of faith, but an understandable one, I suppose. I think very much that there's a sense that Hardy is grappling with belief in that, and a desire to want to believe. And, so often isn't that the first thing that leads us to an encounter with Christ, not even that we accept him as true, but that we have a desire to want to accept him as true or real. So I really think that's a beautiful expression of both the ambivalence and desire of the drama.
It's also, I think, an expression that many people have about Christmas. In other words, people who lack faith or have a weak faith, Christmas is a kind of reminder, or it's a fairly stark reminder, of either what they lack or of what they are struggling with and what they're doubtful of. And I think the first thing that many people do when they're struck by that is they go back to a time in childhood or which they identify with childhood when nor did it occur to one of us there to doubt they were kneeling then. So when you're young and you're listening to your elders, you don't doubt or it doesn't occur to you to doubt. And I think a lot of folks at Christmas want to put their doubts aside and they want to answer the call, but they're not sure if they will. They're not sure if they will finally overcome the doubts that have grown up with them through adulthood.
I think that's right, Dale. What you say there is perfectly evocative of a conversation I was having with a dear friend of mine who's not a believer. And, you know, our conversation was kind of funny. We meet for lunch and we, you know, talk about the things friends talk about, with, you know, what's going on with life. And, of course, I was expressing to him my less-than-subtle Grinchness when it comes to Christmas season. I suppose it's an occupational he joked that it was an occupational hazard that I would be complaining that the season has lost its meaning, and I was trying to convince people what its real meaning was, and he was just simply complaining about the season because he doesn't believe any of what it is. And but he said something very interesting in our conversation. He said, I do wish I could enjoy some of the peace that would simply come from the idea that a baby could be a savior.
Right.
And I do think that what he was saying speaks to that, that primordial sense of seeking an innocence, of seeking an innocence, a purity, that, you know, we don't encounter very often in the hardship of life, whether we're a believer or not. Life is difficult. The postmodern world is a confusing place. And regardless of what one believes about it or not, we've all had experiences that, that want us, that evokes that desire in us for something that is pure and real and innocent. And I think that is one of the great beauties that poetry is so, you know, marvelously able to express in a way that prose can't in the Christmas season.
Well, I like, you know, you began, Father DeVue, by saying that you had a lacuna in your education, that you were a prose man and not necessarily poetry, but you did the three, in reading the poem the way you did, the original poem that you read by Newman, Christmas Without Christ, you did the three things that any reader of poetry needs to do. Number one, you read it slowly. You didn't rush through it. Number two, you let yourself sink into it. It wasn't something, it wasn't just getting the words out. It was trying to embody them with your voice and your diction and your cadence and so forth. And thirdly, you let them sing. And if poetry wants to sing, let it sing. Don't read against it.
My dear friend, who is an English professor and all that, he we went on a long flight together a few years ago, coming back from Italy, and all the things I brought to entertain myself failed me. And he is always, of course, as I mentioned, gigging me about you know, the lacuna in my education. So I said, listen, professor, I said, since we're on this plane for, you know, 8-9 hours, I said, teach me how to read verse. I said, teach me how to do it. I said, you know, don't teach me about it. Teach me how to do it. And one of the things he said is, he said, any poem that's worth reading must be read out loud.
Right.
And,
absolutely.
He goes, and if you do that and you do it slowly, eventually the words will transport you. And of course, now, that for the first time ever, that little instruction began to make poetry make sense to me as a man who praised the word to the sacred liturgy every day. Very often the cadence of the words or the cadence of the chant and music that accompanies the word is what forms the experience and makes it deeper even than the word, the reality being represented by the words themselves, does it not? And so for the first time that began to make sense to me, and poetry became a little more accessible to me.
Probably a lot more. I'm talking with Father Philip DeVue, who is pastor of the St. Joseph Parish in Crescent Springs, Kentucky. Now, let me ask you, do you bring the same approach to reading the gospel at Mass?
I do, largely because that was the way I was trained. I was trained by a Norbertine in terms of my liturgical formation, you know, a beautiful order that that has held on to, you know, the richness of the Church's liturgical tradition. And so, like I said, that little instruction from my friend, from his expertise, connected with a stream of things I had been taught in my expertise. And so I very much so in terms of enunciating the words of the sacred liturgy, in terms of trying to make sure to enunciate the gospel and the other liturgical texts in a way that, that their cadence and their beauty can be proclaimed in a way that is more than just the saying of words, but rather the
enactment.
The enactment of the words, the letting the words do the transporting. I have to say, you know, Isn't it wonderful that we have, and this doesn't have anything to do with poetry, but isn't it wonderful that we have the new translation of the liturgical texts, which are not only theologically more accurate and rich and deep, but they're also easier to transport one. They're also easier to evoke a different realm of being and of experience, precisely because in many instances they are less prosaic, even where they have become more theologically complicated. A different word properly enunciated that doesn't fit into my daily experience is something that causes me to pause and reflect, does it not?
Let's face it, language that is liturgical language, which is meant to be spoken and sung, it has to fit the ear.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And again, a lot of the liturgical language we've been hearing over the last 20 or 30 years doesn't. Now, you brought a poem about Christmas by the great G.K. Chesterton. Which did you bring?
Well, I have two. Now one is, actually, can I share one that's not strictly about Christmas, but has always spoke a very important theme of Christmas to me? It's called The Donkey. Would that be okay?
Well, I think anything called The Donkey has got to be close to Christmas anyway.
Well, and I'll explain why.
Go ahead.
So it's The Donkey by G.K. Chesterton. When fishes flew and forests walked and figs grew up upon the thorn, some moment when the moon was blood, then surely I was born. With monstrous head and sickening cry and ears like errant wings, the devil's walking parody on all four-footed things. The tattered outlaw of the earth, of ancient crooked will, starve, scourge, deride me. I am dumb. I keep my secret still. Fools, for I also had my hour. One far fierce hour and sweet, there was a shout about my ears and palms before my feet.
Very powerful poem, and for our listeners, the image of the donkey has often been used to be a metaphor for Christ. One of the most famous instances was a great French film by the Catholic director Robert Bresson entitled Hazard de Balthazar, about the way a donkey is mistreated by four owners in succession to the point where the donkey is completely broken and dies. And it's one of the saddest, but one of the most Christological films ever made. But here we have, Father DeVue has brought us this one by Chesterton, which has sadness as well, does it not?
It does. This poem, of course, speaks directly to Palm Sunday realities, Christ entrance into Jerusalem on the donkey. Now, the reason I talk about this one, or I brought this one, came up and has always come up in my mind on Christmas, is because as a little child, I had a family nativity set that we set up in our home every year. And, of course, when you're a little child, the animals are the things that are most, compelling to you when you're setting them out. And I remember there were two sort of ridiculous-looking donkeys that, despite the artistry of the whole nativity set, the two donkeys apparently were not as crafted with as fine a hand. And yet, somehow, when I read Chesterton's poem here many, many years ago, probably in high school, and the donkey talks about how ugly he is. My image immediately was filled with those two donkeys in our family nativity set. So my image of what that donkey looks like is that. And of course, here is the donkey being portrayed, on the day that he had palms under his feet. And of course, we're thinking of Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem to complete the sacrifice that will affect our salvation forever. And I also thought of the donkeys there in the stable,
right,
the cradle of redeeming love. The wood of the cradle, prefigures the wood of the cross. And I have always thought in my spiritual imagination that the little baby donkey that must have been there as a small donkey was the adult donkey that carried Jesus into Jerusalem. As Benedict,
I'm struck by
were you there? So you can't say I'm wrong.
I'm struck by these two lines. Starve, scourge, deride me. I am dumb. I keep my secret still. What secret is that, Father?
I have always contemplated that and thought that to be the secret of divine love. That, you know, the world will reject divine love. The world will hate it. The world will, dismiss it. The world will try to destroy it. And yet, the secret is still kept. And of course, for those who choose to come near, to adore, the secret is made known.
Read it one more time, The Donkey, sure. By G.K. Chesterton.
When fishes flew and forests walked, and figs grew upon thorn, some moment when the moon was blood, then surely I was born. With monstrous head and sickening cry, and ears like errant wings, the devil's walking parody on all four-footed things. The tattered outlaw of the earth, of ancient crooked will, starve, scourge, deride me, I am dumb, I keep my secret still. Fools, for I also had my hour, one far fierce hour and sweet, there was a shout about my ears and palms before my feet.
That was Father Philip DeVue, a friend and accomplice, reading The Donkey by G.K. Chesterton as part of our hour devoted to Christmas poetry. We began with John Henry Newman's Christmas Without Christ. We then took a look at the novelist, English novelist Thomas Hardy's The Oxen. And after a short break, we're going to come back and look at another poem by G.K. Chesterton that Father DeVue has brought. We're also going to look to what is perhaps the most famous Christmas poem of all, The Journey of the Magi by T.S. Eliot. Please stay with us. After this short message, we will return, talk more about Christmas, and read more beautiful poetry.
I called a friend to check up on her. She had been going through a personal crisis, and I could tell when she answered the phone she had been crying. We talked for a while, and while on the phone, I was silently praying to God that He would give me the words He knew she needed to hear. I've been reciting that prayer for months, and almost every day I would come across a biblical quote or an inspirational saying that I would text to her or email to her. She said to me on the phone that day, "Do you know those quotes you're sending me are keeping me going? You always seem to text me exactly what I needed to hear at that moment." Our faith teaches us that we all have crosses to bear in life. In Psalms it reads, "Passing through the valley of weeping, you'll find pools of blessings." And when you're in the valley, if you'll stay in faith, knowing that God has something better, He'll take those tears and turn them into pools to refresh you. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communication evangelist.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
On the next Christ is the Answer program, Father Ricardo talks for the evening men's group at his parish. It's a talk about family, fatherhood, and his own father, and the man who ordained him. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday evenings at 7, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
with Father Philip DeVue, and we are talking about Christmas poetry. And Father DeVue has brought some of his favorites, and we're going to turn now to another by G.K. Chesterton. What's the name of this poem, Father?
This poem is known by many different things, but the name it's most commonly goes under is The House of Christmas by G.K.
But it's also called what? What's its other title?
I've seen it in other anthologies listed as A Christmas Carol Poem, and in other places I've simply seen it noted as A Christmas Poem by Chesterton.
I suggest that we read this one antiphonally. It's five stanzas. They're not long, but why don't you start with the first, and then I'll come in after you.
Very well. Okay. The House of Christmas by G.K. Chesterton. There fared a mother driven forth out of an inn to roam. In the place where she was homeless, all men are at home. The crazy stable close at hand, with shaking timber and shifting sand, grew a stronger thing to abide and stand than the square stones of Rome.
For men are homesick in their homes and strangers under the sun, and they lay on their heads in a foreign land whenever the day is done. Here we have battle and blazing eyes and chance and honor and high surprise, but our homes are under miraculous skies where the Yule tale was begun.
A child in a foul stable where the beasts feed and foam. Only where he was homeless are you and I at home. We have hands that fashion and heads that know, but our hearts we lost how long ago. In a place no chart nor ship can show, under the sky's dome.
The world is wild as an old wives' tale, and strange the plain things are. The earth is enough, and the air is enough for our wonder and our war. But our rest is as far as the fire drake swings, and our peace is put in impossible things. We're clashed and thundered unthinkable wings round an incredible star.
To an open house in the evening, home shall men come. To an older place than Eden, and taller town than Rome. To the end of the way of wandering star, to the things that cannot be and that are. To the place where God was homeless, and all men are at home.
That was G.K. Chesterton's poem, wonderful poem, The House of Christmas. You know, on the surface of it, it's a rather simple and straightforward poem, but it actually gives us a lot to chew on. I want to go to the line that you read about the only place where we can be at home is where he was homeless. What do you make of that?
You know, I always think of St. Paul's instruction to us when I read that line, our citizenship is in heaven. You know, the divine mystery of God's humility and the Son of God eschewing all that was rightfully his of the majesty of heaven to come among us in humility, in his humanity, in that humanity of ours. And so as to bring man back to God, back to that communion he was meant to enjoy. And so, you know, we are citizens of heaven because of that divine adoption that our Heavenly Father has achieved for us in the person of Christ. And so to know that he is here, to know that he has come among us, while this is not his home, I mean, heaven is his home, that is where we find our true self. You know, that is where we find that which we are meant to be in the divine plan of God. And our citizenship is in heaven. And doesn't that put so much of so many of the things that are sources of tension and anxiety and sin for us in their proper perspective?
Only where he was homeless are you and I at home. That's prefiguring our ultimate home, wouldn't you
Absolutely.
Think?
Absolutely. And even in this life, you know, deal through that gift of grace, the gift of faith, you know, that recognition. And I think every soul has had some experience of this. We hope a lot. In our communion with Christ, even as we are here in our exile, do we not feel more secure than we do, you know, in the world, day in and day out. And that sense that, you know, we find our anchor, our truth, our real selves, you know, the beginning of our being at home in our communion with Christ, so that no matter where we're at in this world, we can at least have, you know, a little bit of ourselves in our true homeland. That is, I think, one of the tremendous, of the many tremendous gifts that communion with Christ, friendship with Christ, you know, brings to us. And, you know, with him we are at home, waiting for that day that we're at home, you know, forever in that totally fulfilled way. I mean, what a tremendous mystery. And yet how human, because we all long for that, don't we? I mean, you know, listen to all the Christmas songs on the radio, some of greater and lesser quality. It strikes me, I was thinking this the other day as I was in the car making my rounds at the going to the hospital. Every one of them talks about home in some way. Every single one of them. I can't think of a single one that doesn't have some mention of it. I'm sure there are, but all the ones I heard, you know, the last few days, there's something primordial about that. And yet it's a fact of our faith that with him we are home.
I'm talking with Father Philip DeVue, pastor of the St. Joseph Parish in Crescent Springs, Kentucky. Now, this is north of Cincinnati, isn't it?
South, just south, about
just south of Cincinnati, south. Right. And so, but you're proudly from Kentucky, even though you might claim a little bit of Ohioan as well. Is that true?
Well, I my citizenship is in heaven deal. So
that's what we just read, anyway.
So we just read. So, but you know, having grown up in Illinois, I used to be very proud of claiming Illinois. I'm depending on who I'm talking to, I don't reveal that my part of my past much these days, given all that the poor state of Illinois has been through. But I grew up there, studied in St. Louis, and I've lived here in Northern Kentucky now for about 13 years.
So you were Jesuit trained.
I was. I went to St. Louis University. And then actually, you know, at the Pontifical College Josephinum, which is a diocesan seminary at the time that I was a student there, we had a number of Jesuits, very fine Jesuits on the faculty there. And so I had many more Jesuit professors at the Josephinum, which was a diocesan seminary, than I did when I was at St. Louis University, which is, as you know, a Jesuit institution. So the Jesuits have been a long presence in my intellectual and spiritual formation, for which I'm thankful.
Of course. Now we're talking about an intellectual poet. We're turning to T.S. Eliot, who was American-born, but lived most of his life in England and never became a Catholic, remained in Church of England. He, of course, like C.S. Lewis, had a tremendous affinity with all things Catholic. And when you look at Anglicans like Lewis and T.S. Eliot, you really have to really push hard to find much difference in the core beliefs that they have. Wouldn't you agree with that, Father?
I would agree. I mean, there's a very serious and convinced and knowledgeable Christianity running through them all you know, I think speak to anyone who takes that seriously.
Struck us. And this particular poem, though, I want to warn our readers or our listeners, we're the readers, warn our listeners that it's not a real upbeat poem, and I've chosen it on purpose because Christmas has, as Father already pointed out in an earlier poem, a penitential side. And this one basically is a story of the journey of the Magi to Bethlehem, and tells it in an entirely penitential mode. Have you had a chance to read it prior to our being on the show here, Father?
I did. You know, I was so delighted when you suggested it, partly because, you know, Dale, providence works in funny ways. You suggested this poem would be part of our discussion today. And I just was cleaning up my private office the other day, and I'm not making this up. The book that was on top of a pile that I had long needed to organize was, guess what? T.S. Eliot.
Wow. Okay.
Plays. So,
what do you know? Okay. Well, here's how we're going to do this.
Our reading is a great one.
This is in three parts. It's not long. I'll read the first stanza, you the second, and I'll do the third. And I want our listeners to be patient with this because you've never heard it. This will be the journey of the Magi for grown-ups, the one you've never heard. The Journey of the Magi by T.S. Eliot. A cold coming we had of it. Just the worst time of the year for a journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter. And the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women. And the night fires going out and the lack of shelters and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears saying that it was all folly.
Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet, below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and water mill beating the darkness, and three trees on the low sky, and an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel. Six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued and arrived at evening, not a moment too soon. Finding the place, it was, you may say, satisfactory.
All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would have do it again, but set down this. Were we led all that way for birth or death? It was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We return to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. As I told our listeners, this is not the wise men ending up at the manger with the angels singing and the shepherds kneeling. This is a story of a spiritual dark night, as it were. What do you think that this particular magus, this magician, this king, is saying in this last line when he's saying, I should be glad of another death?
I think he's very clearly understanding his death, earthly death, as the passage into that birth, which, you know, the person of Christ, the child of Christ, the Christ the Redeemer, Christ on the cross, Christ resurrected, calls us to. He alludes to that. I couldn't help but think today, you know, today's readings for Mass was about how the violent seize the kingdom of God. And I think back...
The violent bear it away.
Bear it away. Hard and bitter agony for us, like death. And isn't that transformation... Isn't that transformation into Christ? There is, we have to do violence to ourselves once we've had that encounter with Him. We have to put off the old man, the worldly man, the cynical man, the impure man, the dumb man.
We are no longer at ease here in the old dispensation with an alien people clutching their gods.
I mean, this is clearly a man who has seen a vision, who has realized the truth, but a truth not yet fulfilled in him.
Well, he doesn't want to give up his that wonderful line, doesn't want, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. He hardly wants to give that up, does he?
No. I mean, we all understand that. We all understand, you know, that pride of life, that lust of the eyes, that is so much a part of.
Well, just pure comfort. I mean,
pure comfort, status. Self-determination, indulgence.
I love the way you read the line, which is really a funny line. I had to stifle myself from laughing because you have this, it's really the last three lines of the second stanza. But there was no information. You know, they arrive at Bethlehem.
Okay.
And so we continued in arriving at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place it was. You might say satisfactory. You know, they thought they were coming to see a king, right?
Well, of course he's a king, and he expected something better for himself. on this journey. And yet, you know, this is no normal king, because, you know, despite the revelations of himself, the seeking the comfort and the realization of his own status, he still presses on to something more and recognizes that the something more may well ask him to give up all of that. So there's a humility to the man.
Oh, great. He's been broken.
Yeah, broken. He has been broken, and he knows those things are lovely, but they're not enough. He's learned that, even though he hasn't quite totally achieved that. But isn't that like we all know what that experience is like in our own way, don't we?
And, you know, he's a realist, too, because when he comes to the place, he sees images of the crucifixion, he sees images of the betrayal of Christ. He sees all the suffering that's going to be in the life of this baby that he's about to adore.
Yeah.
Why don't you reread that second stanza? I think it's so powerful.
Okay. But at dawn we came down to a temperate valley, wet, below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a watermill beating the darkness, and three trees on the low sky. And an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued. And arriving at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place, it was, you may say, satisfactory.
I know Eliot has a very famous recording of him reading this poem. It's actually available on the internet in a lot of places. Just search for T.S. Eliot reading The Journey of the Magi, and he has this very, very cranky, acerbic, edgy voice. A cold coming we had of it, you know. And I mean, he eliminates any roundness, any softness, any, you might say, tenderness almost, in the poem, which, frankly, I think goes a little far, but it's his poem. Who am I to criticize, right?
Right.
But you see, now, interesting that there is this, as he's remembering the journey, in the last stanza, which really isn't a stanza, it's just a part of the poem, he's remembering it from a distance. He still has not made a decision about whether to die to himself, because that's what we're talking about. He has still not made that decision. I have seen birth and death. But what was this, birth or death? He said he knows he must die because he's no longer happy with the silken girls carrying sherbet or with the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces. It's no longer for him satisfactory, or he found out it never was really satisfactory, right?
Yeah, it's exactly right. This is clearly a man who has everything and yet reveals a tremendous skepticism toward it all, even while enjoying it. And you know, matter of fact, we see him come a little further, because you know, in that second to last line of the poem, you know, people clutching their gods. So he has certainly come to a realization that these things are totally insufficient,
yes,
for what I'm looking for.
What's holding him back? I mean, if he sees it that clearly, why doesn't he just get on with it?
I would suspect T.S. Eliot would ask that question of every single one of us.
Right, okay. Fair enough. Touche.
Isn't that the call of it all, deal?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
We know so much. We've been graced with the knowledge of so much, you know, that even the least in the kingdom are higher than John the Baptist. And yet, how often do we hold back giving our whole selves to him? That of course,
every
is
day.
That journey of conversion. You know, every
day
we're holding something back or praying
day.
Not to hold back.
Mm-hmm.
I think Eliot has just done a marvelous job at bringing us all right to the poetic precipice
of conversion.
Of conversion.
Sorry to complete your thought.
No, that's
you and I think alike. I want to move over to a poem you may not know, Father, and I didn't warn you about this because I hadn't really thought of it until after we discuss it. And
that's why I confessed my lacunae early on in the
book. Yeah, you sort of got yourself out of the way of the criticism. And this is by T.S. Eliot's good friend W.H. Auden, who is right at the elbow of Eliot as one of the great American poets of modernism, but like Eliot, a very devout Christian, Auden himself a Catholic. And he was asked by Benjamin Britten, the great British composer, to write an oratorio for Christmas, and he came up with a text entitled For the Time Being, A Christmas Oratorio, and it's almost as long as Shakespeare's Macbeth. And it, of course, Britten, the great composer he was, couldn't, that would have been an opera, essentially, to set that up. But he did take part of it. But the interesting thing about this poem, Father, and I think, is when I was a Baptist, we used to find things, and we would say to each other, boy, this will preach. Well, this Auden poem will preach, because basically what it is a critique, or really a deconstruction of the trivialization of Christmas. You know, the shopping and the frantic nature of it. It's very, very long, and obviously I'm not going to read, but just a snatch of it, and I'd love to get your take on it. Just to introduce it a little bit, again, it was written between 42 and 44, that is during the war, was published right at the end of the war, and I think it's a pity that people don't know it better, but it's so darn long, you really can't blame, you know, people for not wanting to sit down and spend, you know, like 3 weeks reading a poem. But I'll give you a few snippets of it, and you'll see that he is absolutely unflinching, and he doesn't hold anything back when it comes to the way in which we conduct ourselves at Christmas. W.H. Auden, the very end of his Christmas oratorio entitled For the Time Being. Well, so that is that. Now we must dismantle the tree, putting decorations back into their cardboard boxes, some have got broken, and carrying them up to the attic. The holly and the mistletoe must be taken down and burnt, and the children got ready for school. There are enough leftovers to do, warmed up for the rest of the week. Not that we have much appetite, having drunk such a lot, stayed up so late, attempted quite unsuccessfully to love all of our relatives, and in general grossly overestimated our powers. Once again, as in previous years, we have seen the actual vision, capital V, by the way, and failed to do more than entertain it as an agreeable possibility, capital P. Once again, we have sent him, capital H, away, begging, though, to remain his disobedient servant, the promising child who cannot keep his word for long. Do you think that'll preach, Father?
I think that, it's too late now. I gave a homily on this very subject on the first Sunday of Advent, and because of my lacunae, I didn't know that. I could simply have gotten up and read that and saved the congregation several minutes of my going on about the subject.
And you could have got a laugh, too. You know, at the same time you smacked your congregation around, you could have, so much more powerful because you can laugh at yourself.
You can, the state that he describes has only worsened since that was published. I have a game I play, and I don't know if I should announce this to the your audience, but, my secret will now be known, is that on December 26th, I get in my car, and I've done this the whole time I've been a priest, and I drive through the sacred precincts of my parish, and I try to see how many Christmas trees are out on the corner to be disposed of on December 26th. My all-time high is 27. Oh. And every time I see that, I always think, how sad.
That's a very Auden moment.
Speaks to that attitude that Auden is revealing to us there.
I'm sorry this hour of Christmas poems has come to a close. I've been talking with Father Philip DeVue, pastor of the St. Joseph Parish. They're very lucky, by the way, to have you, in Crescent Springs, Kentucky. And we have read and discussed some wonderful Christmas poetry. We ended with W.H. Auden's For the Time Being, Father DeVue, thank you so much for being a guest on Church and Culture, and will you come back?
Dale, it's been a delight to be with you, and I'd be delighted to come back.
We will have you again. And for all of you who are listening, please join us again at this time and place for next week's episode of Church and Culture.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Are you tired of the way your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. For the same reason you listen to Ave Maria, get the Michigan Catholic for just $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.com.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, all families have their story, from sinners to saints. So it is with the family of Jesus Christ. But God still works out His divine plan, which is the miracle of this season.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio. Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by a contribution made from our day sponsor. To celebrate the 15th birthday of Michael, son of Dr. Miguel and Irene Lisplanelis, may Christ continue to guide your path. You can be a day sponsor too. Just pick up the phone and call toll free 1-877-288-1077 and say, "I want to be a day sponsor."
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Sunday's first reading tells us how King David wanted to build a house or temple for God, but instead God promised that he'll build a house and a line for him. Now we're fast coming to the birthday of great David's greater son at Christmas, and so the Gospel tells us the story of Jesus' conception, which happened like this. The angel Gabriel was sent to Nazareth to a virgin betrothed to Joseph, and her name was Mary. And he greeted her, "Hail, full of grace, the Lord is with you." But she was greatly troubled at what was said, and pondered what sort of greeting this might be. Then the angel said, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you found favor with God. You'll conceive and bear a son, and you shall name him Jesus. He will be great, and the Lord God will give him the throne of David his father, and he'll rule over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." But Mary said to the angel, "How can this be, since I have no relations with a man?" The angel replied, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you, and the child to be born will be called Holy, the Son of God. And behold, Elizabeth, your relative, has also conceived a son in her old age. And